When James and I arrived at the Airbnb, I could tell this place would be perfect. Gated community, pool, exercise room. Everything felt just upscale enough to keep the neighbors at a distance while giving us room to work. Another rental, another game. James wasn't as excited about our hobby anymore, but I could still see a flicker of that old fire in his eyes. He pretended to hate it, but deep down he loved the rush, the power of knowing we controlled the narrative. We didn't just play pranks. We tested people, pushed them to their limits, exposed their fears. The neighbor was easy to read. A loner, restless, not much of a talker. Perfect. All we needed was to set the stage, and he'd play his part. The first act. The argument wasn't our best performance, but it did the job. James flubbed his lines, and I had to improvise a bit when he hesitated, but the fake blood was a nice touch. Watching the neighbor's horrified face through the window was satisfying. His panic, his desperation to call the cops, it was delicious. When the cops showed up, I almost lost it. I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing as James and I walked out like innocent bystanders. The police believed every word I said. They always do. I can cry on command. And James has that sheepish, regretful look down to an art. The best part was the look on our neighbor's face when I told him the truth. Watching the realization dawn on him, watching him struggle between anger and confusion, it was perfect. No hard feelings, right? I'd said. He didn't answer. They never do. The second act. That night, I pretended to sleep, waiting for James to make his move. I knew he was getting restless, knew he was thinking about leaving. He'd been pulling away for months now, but I wasn't about to let him ruin my fun. Not yet. When I heard him climb out the window, I smiled. Predictable. I gave him just enough time to make it to the neighbor's place before I got up and turned on the lights. The neighbor lied to me, of course, said he hadn't seen James. That was fine. I didn't need the truth from him. I just needed to know where James was. The final act. I waited until they were both asleep before I made my move. It was almost too easy. James had always been a heavy sleeper, and the neighbor was clearly too naive to see the bigger picture. I crept through the window, knife in hand, and finished what I'd started. James didn't even stir as I drove the blade into his face. I made sure it was messy, bloody, chaotic. Then I placed the knife in the neighbor's hand, smearing his fingerprints all over the handle. By the time the cops arrived in the morning, I was ready. I played my part perfectly. Hysterical, distraught, inconsolable. The neighbor was confused, disoriented, still trying to piece together what had happened. He never stood a chance. As they hauled him away, I made sure to cry loud enough for the whole neighborhood to hear. It wasn't until I leaned into the car window that I dropped the act. "I'm sorry," I whispered, my voice barely audible over his protests. "This has nothing to do with you." And it didn't. Not really. He was just a pawn in a bigger game. You see, James was never supposed to leave me. I warned him what would happen if he tried. He thought I was bluffing. Thought I needed him to keep playing our little games. But he underestimated me. He always did. As the car pulled away, I turned back to the house. It was time to pack up and move on. Another rental, another neighbor, another story. James was gone, but the game wasn't over. Not yet. In the distance, I could hear the neighbor screaming my name. It almost sounded like music. Jenny was always the wild card, a bratty little sister who thrived on taking up space. And yet, she was never the problem. The real problem was her older sister, my girlfriend. For someone so desperate to escape her family's suffocating grasp, she clung to them like a parasite. Every plan, every date, every conversation was always about them. Her parents, Jenny, their traditions, their fights. It was exhausting. But not this weekend. This weekend was supposed to be ours. A camping trip far away from the noise, the guilt tripping, and especially Jenny. When she told me her sister was coming along, I nearly called the whole thing off. But no, I thought, this was an opportunity. A chance to show her how toxic her family was. A chance to show her that I was the only person she really needed. When they arrived at the campsite, it was already ruined. None of her friends had shown up. Of course, I knew they wouldn't. I may have told them that Jenny was unbearable, that she'd ruin everything. They didn't need much convincing. Jenny immediately started yapping about something inconsequential. Ugh. Her voice grated on my nerves like nails on a chalkboard. But I kept my cool. I had bigger plans. Eventually, I suggested a walk. Just me and her, leaving Jenny to stew in her tent. I watched my girlfriend snap at her sister, saying something sharp that made the kid fold in on herself like a crumbled piece of paper. Good. She was learning. The woods were dense and quiet, just how I liked them. I led her deeper, to a spot I'd found earlier that week. A clearing with twisted trees and a crack in the earth so deep that it seemed to lead straight to hell. She didn't notice my excitement. She never noticed much about me, too wrapped up in her own self-pity. I laid out the picnic blanket and unpacked the food, pretending like this was just another romantic gesture. She sat down, but her posture was stiff. Her mind was somewhere else, probably back at the tent worrying about her little sister. "Do you ever think about us?" I asked, my voice calm but heavy. She blinked, confused. What do you mean? I mean, do you ever think about what I want? Or is it always about them? The way her face twisted, half confusion, half guilt, made something inside me snap. I didn't raise my voice, I didn't need to. I just kept talking, letting years of frustration boil over in the calmest, most deliberate tone I could manage. She tried to reason with me, of course, tried to say that things would be different now that she was 18, but I knew better. People don't change. Not really. When she stood up to leave, I grabbed her arm. Her eyes widened, and for the first time, I saw real fear. It was intoxicating. "You're not going anywhere," I said. "You're mine." I pushed her, just hard enough to send her stumbling backward. She hit the ground and disappeared into the crack. The sound of her body hitting the rocky floor below was satisfying. I peered over the edge, smiling as she writhed in pain. She was yelling something, begging me to help her, but her voice was muffled by the walls of the chasm. "I'm the only one who knows you're here," I said. "You'll thank me someday. When it's just the two of us, you'll finally see." I laid out my plan, savoring every word. She wouldn't die down there. I'd bring her food, water, everything she needed. She'd rely on me completely, just like she should have all along. But then I heard a sound behind me, a sharp rustling, like leaves being crushed underfoot. I turned just in time to see Jenny charging toward me. Before I could react, she shoved me hard, her small hands filled with an unexpected strength. The world flipped upside down as I tumbled into the pit. My head hit something sharp, and everything went black. When I came to, I was still in the pit. My head throbbed, my vision blurry. Above me, I could hear the sisters talking. Their voices were muffled, but unmistakably close.
"I knew we shouldn't trust him," Jenny said.
"Thank you for saving me,"
my girlfriend replied. Her voice was softer now, almost tender. I tried to call out to them, but my throat was dry, my voice weak. They didn't even look down.
"Do you think he's dead?"
Jenny asked.
"No," she said after a pause. "But he will be."
And then, without another word, they started piling rocks into the hole. The first one hit my leg. The second hit my chest. By the time the third one came down, I knew that they weren't just trying to cover the hole, they were trying to bury me alive. I screamed, but it only seemed to make them work faster. Their laughter echoed down the pit, growing fainter with every rock they dropped. As the darkness closed in around me, I realized that I hadn't underestimated Jenny. I'd underestimated both of them. And now, they'd make sure no one ever found me. I never thought a smell could define me, could awaken something primal and unshakable inside me. But it did. The moment I switched to the natural deodorant, I felt alive in a way I never had before. It was raw, untamed, unapologetically me. The scent wasn't just a smell, it was a declaration, a reminder that I was shedding society's chains and embracing something purer. But Emma, my fiancé, couldn't see that. She couldn't feel it. "It's unbearable, David," she said one night, her voice trembling as she stood on the other side of the room, as far from me as she could get. "It's not normal. You smell awful." I smiled, running the deodorant stick over my arm like a sacred ritual. "It's natural, Emma. This is what a real man smells like." Her face twisted in disgust. "No, David! This is what insanity smells like!" Her words stung, but I didn't let it show. I couldn't. She didn't understand what this meant to me. To her, it was just a deodorant. To me, it was a revolution. A casting off of synthetic lies and chemical slavery. I loved the smell. It was earthy, sharp, almost animalistic. It was freedom. Emma, though, couldn't see it that way. She started pulling away, retreating to the spare bedroom at night, avoiding me during the day. Her distance felt like betrayal, her inability to support my choices cutting deeper than any insult. The apartment felt colder without her warmth. But I told myself it didn't matter. I had my truth, my identity, my scent. The final straw came after a weekend trip. We'd taken the bus together and people stared, their whispers louder than they thought. Emma was mortified. She refused to sit next to me on the ride back, opting for a seat at the front while I stayed in the rear, basking in my solitude and the air I filled with my essence. When we got home, she exploded.
"Do you even care how humiliating that was?"
she yelled, slamming her bag onto the floor.
"People were gagging, David! They were whispering about us!"
"About me," I corrected, my voice calm, even. "Not you. And I don't care what they think. They're sheep, blind to the truth."
"No, David," she snapped, her eyes blazing. "You're delusional. This isn't about truth or freedom. It's about your obsession. You've let this stench consume you."
"Obsession? Stench?" She didn't understand. She never would. I stared at her, the love I'd once felt now curdling into something darker. "You don't get it, do you?" I said quietly, stepping closer to her. She flinched, but didn't back away. "This smell, it's me. It's who I am. And if you can't accept that, then maybe you shouldn't be here." Her laugh was bitter, hollow.
"Maybe I shouldn't."
That night she packed a bag. I watched her move through the apartment, her movements sharp, angry, purposeful. She didn't speak to me, and I didn't stop her. But as she reached for the door, I felt something snap inside me. She couldn't leave. She couldn't just walk away, throwing everything we had away over something as trivial as a smell. "Emma," I said, my voice low, almost a growl. She paused, her hand on the doorknob. "If you walk out that door, you're making a mistake." She turned to me, her eyes filled with a mix of anger and pity. "The only mistake I made was staying this long." The world went red. I don't remember grabbing the lamp from the table. I don't remember the sound it made when it connected with her head, the sickening crunch, the way her body crumbled to the floor.
All I remember is the silence that followed, heavy and absolute. I stood over her, breathing hard, the smell of my deodorant mingling with the coppery tang of blood. It was intoxicating. She had been wrong, blind, incapable of understanding the truth. But now, she was silent. Now, she couldn't insult me, couldn't undermine my choices, couldn't make me feel small. I dragged her body to the bathroom, the only place where the scent wouldn't be overwhelmed by the smell of decay. I cleaned up the blood, careful, methodical, my mind eerily calm. When I was done, I sat in the living room, the stick of deodorant in my hand, savoring its scent. This was who I was. This was freedom, and no one would ever take it from me.
My boss had recently cut my hours, and I could no longer pay for rent. I didn't want to move out of my apartment, so I figured my best option would be to find a roommate. The first person I thought of was my cousin, Lexi. The last time we talked, she couldn't stop complaining about her annoying roommate. I knew she'd jump at the chance to move in with me instead. I called her, but she didn't answer. A few minutes later, she texted me back. Lexi was a bit less confident than me, and I learned over the years that she was always more comfortable texting. I told her I was looking for a new roommate to move in as soon as possible. It would have to be under the table, because my landlord wouldn't allow another name on my lease. That's why I needed someone like Lexi, someone I could trust. She told me that she couldn't, but she recommended I reach out to her friend, Samantha. Samantha was one of Lexi's oldest friends. I'd met her a few times when she was still in elementary school, but it had been years since I'd thought about her. Through text, Lexi assured me that Samantha would make the perfect roommate. Because I trusted Lexi's opinion, I gave Samantha a call. Unlike my cousin, Samantha actually picked up the phone. Her voice sounded very pleasant, and I immediately got a good feeling. She agreed to move in and pay her half of the rent directly to me. She even offered to pitch in on utilities, which wasn't even something I'd asked for. How could I say no? We met the next day for coffee, and our short introductory meeting stretched on for over 2 hours. She was so easy to talk to. I felt like we'd known each other forever. We made a verbal agreement, and she moved in the next day. At first, everything was fine. She cooked dinner for me and even vacuumed our floors. She said she wanted to be the best roommate ever. She lived with me for a whole week before I realized that something was off. I had come home late from work and fell asleep on the couch. In the middle of the night, I woke up to find Samantha standing over me, slowly combing my hair. I jerked back in surprise, not realizing that her comb was still in my hair. The sudden movement ripped out a big chunk of my own hair. Samantha was apologetic, of course. She explained that she had seen my beautiful hair hanging over the arm of the couch and she wanted to help me get rid of all the tangles. I told her that no matter the reason, it was a very inappropriate thing to do. She apologized and said she understood, but that wasn't the last of her weird behavior. After that, she stole my clothes without asking. She snuck into my bedroom and stood at the foot of my bed, watching me. She even brought home a pet iguana without asking me first, so I had to take it back to the shop myself. But it wasn't just the things she did, it was the look she gave me, like she was always worried about getting caught. I didn't know what her deal was, but I started to feel scared around her. I texted Lexi multiple times throughout those first few weeks, but she always stood by her friend. She said I was overreacting, but things just got creepier. I came home one afternoon to find Samantha standing in my room, sniffing my clothes. When she saw me, she acted like it was no big deal. I couldn't even speak. Things had gone way too far. I wordlessly backed out of the apartment and drove straight to Lexi's place. I needed to ask her why she'd ever recommend a psycho like Samantha. When I got there, the front door was half open. I looked inside and saw a policeman pacing around the living room. There were dried bloodstains throughout the room with little number cards next to each one. This was a crime scene. Lexi was dead. I walked inside not thinking. The policeman stopped me at the door and told me to leave. "Please," I said. "My cousin lives here. I need to know what happened to her." The man said that Lexi was indeed the victim. She'd been dead for weeks, but no one had reported her missing because someone had taken her phone and pretended to be her. The only reason the police found her that day was because her neighbor had reported a smell. My knees buckled under me, and the policeman had to catch me before I collapsed. If she'd been dead for weeks, then that meant she wasn't the one who recommended Samantha. Samantha had recommended herself. She'd stolen Lexi's phone. And I guess that meant she'd killed Lexi, too. I told the police officer my suspicions, and he asked if I'd like to come down to the station to give my statement. He offered to take me in his car, but I said I'd rather drive separately. He agreed. I guess he could tell I wasn't a suspect. He went back inside to finish up his investigation, but I didn't leave. I waited along the edge of the house and called Samantha. Trying to sound casual, I told her that I was on my way to Lexi's house for a surprise visit. "Don't," she said. But when I asked her why, she couldn't think of an excuse. Eventually, she said, "Wait for me. I'd like to see her too." And then she hung up. 5 minutes later, she parked her car next to mine and approached me. "You didn't go inside yet, did you?" I glanced towards the window behind me. I could see the policeman just inside, but Samantha didn't. "Yes," I answered her. "She's been murdered." "What?" Samantha said with fake surprise. I looked her dead in the eyes and asked her if she was planning to kill me like she killed Lexi. She looked around, still not noticing the policeman behind the window. She leaned closer and whispered, "Of course. That's what I do." That was all the confession I needed, but she went on. She gleefully explained how she'd find a roommate to live with, mess with them until they noticed, murder them, and then take their identity to find a new place. Then she'd repeat the process all over. It sounded genuinely ridiculous, but she must have been doing this without consequences for a while. "And now that you know everything," she added, "I have no more use for you." And with that, she charged forward and pushed me into the house. She pulled a knife from her pocket, and the most evil-looking grin stretched across her face. That's when she saw the policeman standing just a few feet away. He tackled her to the ground and confiscated her knife. I watched him lead her out of the house. Her psychotic games were finally over. The world around me blurred, the jagged ends hurting me from every corner of my body. My muscles were tired from the events of the night before, and I put my hand down a faucet to clean myself up. I hated being dirty. I hated it more than anything. The debris stuck to my hand. It filled the insides of my fingernails, and it made me feel disgusting. And yet, I was at my happiest and most serene. A night owl cried in the distance, and I peered out through the window to see the full moon in all its glory. It knew my secrets, and it kept them for me. And for that, I was grateful, and I smiled at it. I turned to face myself in the mirror, surprised to see blood. I could feel my bones hurting, and I knew I had exerted myself, but I had done it for my son, who wouldn't have to suffer anymore. I quickly finished washing up and headed back inside. My son was fast asleep, unaware of the evils of the night. It would have ruined him if he knew the extent of the horrible nature of humankind. I stopped by his room and peered in. He was sleeping peacefully with his long lashes resting against his chubby cheeks. He looked like an angel, someone I would protect with everything I had, even if that meant he would only have me as a parent. He didn't know it yet, but I was his mother, his new mother. I returned to my cold bed, where only a moment ago lay someone else. I welcomed the emptiness of it, and I tried not to feel lonely. I closed my eyes and imagined a world where crimes didn't exist, where people were happy, and where I was allowed to have every child I wanted. I would care for them, feed them, and take them to the park when they wanted. They would have ice cream sometimes, but not so much that their teeth would fall off. I slept off with the thoughts of Eddie as my child, and the echoes of the agonizing screaming of people under the dirt. The night was quiet, eerily so. The owl had stopped hooting, and everything else paused, letting the horrifying events of the past few hours settle and the chill run up my every nerve. The following morning was a beautiful day, a new day to be a mother to little Eddie. I opened the drawers in the room and found clothes, pretty dresses that I knew would fit me very well. I dressed up and watched my face in the mirror. I looked pale, so pale that I was nearly translucent. I applied makeup to look as good as possible, and even added blush for some color. Then I went downstairs to call Eddie. "Breakfast will be ready soon," I said this to Eddie after waking him up. He was still looking sleepy, and he frowned up at me. His eyes trailed down to what I was wearing, and I gave him a sickly smile. "Why are you wearing mommy's clothes?" he asked. I frowned, but I didn't say anything at first. I simply guessed that he was still sleepy and was confusing things. "Honey, I am your mother. Have you forgotten me?" I asked, but he kept frowning at me. "Mommy isn't supposed to be here. You're not her." I decided to ignore his words. He was a child after all, and I'd probably forgotten for a little while. "You have grown so well," I said to him. I couldn't remember Eddie growing this much. It felt like yesterday that he was a little child. "I will make you breakfast. I know how much you like Fruit Loops," I smiled. But Eddie shook his head as he followed me into the kitchen. "I don't eat Fruit Loops anymore." Eddie looked at me warily and said, "Are you my mother?" I gave him a wide smile and was surprised to feel a crack in a bone within me. It was painless. "Of course, honey. I am your mother, and I am here to protect you and care for you." "But Daddy said you died," Eddie whispered as though it were a secret, and my blood boiled with the mention of his father and my husband, the man who stabbed a knife clean through my heart only because I wanted to do the same thing to him. I turned around and began making some eggs and toast, but I found it difficult to grip anything. It was all so hard, and it slipped right through. But I was persistent, and I did it. Once breakfast was ready, Eddie wasn't asking questions anymore. He ate in total silence. I watched him fondly, trying to soak up as much of him as I could. The sun was bright now, and it easily filtered through the large kitchen windows, yet I couldn't help but feel very chilly. It was a companion of mine, something to which I had become accustomed. I welcomed the cold and let it completely numb me. After Eddie finished his food, I loaded the dishwasher and cleaned my hands with a rag. I then noticed a lone knife I must have completely forgotten the other night, and it was covered in blood that wasn't mine. I picked it up to wash it, and I saw Eddie look at it with wide eyes, but he said nothing. I didn't want to explain it to him. He left me alone in the kitchen as I scrubbed the dried human blood from the knife, the events of the other night coming back to me. Me, holding the knife and standing above him, cutting his limbs so he could fit into the hole, and then burying him as he screamed for him. It was thoroughly cleaned when Eddie walked in, and I was still holding it. "Where's Dad?" he asked curiously. I should have known he was going to ask, and he was a smart little boy. I held the knife in my hand too tightly and felt the blood trickle down my palm. I had cut myself. "Have you checked the backyard?" I asked the little boy. He nodded at me with a frown and said, "I did, and he's not there." My lips curled widely into a smile that I knew looked horrible, and my blood-red lips and bleeding hand didn't help either. I dropped the knife in the kitchen sink and proceeded to wash my bloodied hands. There was a big gash, but it didn't hurt. "He's in the backyard," I insisted. "Have you tried digging the freshly laid dirt? He's there, and he called for you all night long." I watched the fear creep into Eddie's eyes, and I saw the tears that began to fall as he realized that I had buried his father alive. I needed him to understand. I had to do it, or he wouldn't have let me be his mother. His father killed Eddie's mother once, and now I was here and I refused to leave. I walked up to a paralyzed Eddie and held his arm as firmly as I could. I had to explain this to him. "I am your mother, Eddie. I will be. Your father killed your real mother years ago. I made him kill her. But now, I killed your murderous father too, so you can be safe."
Hold mommy's little hand, child. I am your mother and you listen to me. I couldn't let Eddie live with a monster that was capable of murder. I had to kill him and make him my son. Nothing was as sinister as the terrified look in the child's eyes before me, and I hated to see him that way. But he would adjust. He would understand that I was his mother reborn. In my mind, his dead mother and I were the same, and I made a silent promise to protect him forever.